everyone. I'm Jenny McGregor and I'm CEO of AsiaLink, and it's my enormous honour to welcome you all here tonight and to welcome this fantastic panel that we have. Just a few words of introduction about this series. This is actually the last in AsiaLink's Next Gen series for the year, and we've been really particularly focused this year on putting together forums that appeal to the next gen, because basically the Asian century is in your hands. So we wanted to ensure that you hear voices from your peers and voices particularly who are involved in shaping this place of Australia in this Asian century. You'll all be aware that the government launched a white paper. How long has it? Seems like less than a month ago now. And it really has been, I think, an excellent vehicle for bringing together a range of views and really establishing a roadmap for Australia in this region. And so tonight and through this series, we're going to continue to examine what this means for us all, what this means for all of you, because it is really a fundamental change in our view of ourselves, our view of our future, and it has many implications for the way we're going to do business, and we've got a fabulous panel to address some of these issues tonight. So tonight we have for you, from the Australian Labor Party, Richard Miles, who's the Federal Member for Corio and the Parliamentary Secretary for Pacific Island Affairs and Foreign Affairs. So who better to be on this panel for us tonight? Also from the Liberal Party, we have Kelly O'Dwyer, who's the Federal Member for Higgins and was appointed by her peers as Chairman of the Coalition's Policy Committee on Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade. So you're in extremely good hands tonight to consider what are the foreign policy implications of the Australia in the Asian Century White Paper, what are the big foreign policy considerations facing us as a nation in this incredibly fast-changing world. We're really, really delighted tonight that this event is sponsored by both the University of Melbourne's Australia in the World series and our great partners at the ABC. And we are going to also, as you'll all be well aware from the surrounding environment, we're going to be recorded, and this debate tonight is going to be packaged into a television program. And that television program will be broadcast across the Asia Pacific region, but also, thankfully for us, domestically on ABC News 24 and the Australian Network next Thursday, the 22nd. So that will be next Thursday on Newsline, and all you have to do is Google Newsline and you'll be in there. You'll be able to yet again enjoy this debate. Tonight, we're also absolutely delighted that our moderator is Bev O'Connor, who really is a Victorian icon. And we're delighted that she's able to take on this role for us tonight. She is a presenter with over 20 years' experience on the ABC, and it's a huge privilege to have her here tonight. She is, the ABC actually is incredibly busy this week in China, broadcasting from China every day. So that's why you won't be seeing us live tonight. But we're really delighted, particularly Deborah, that you were able to put this all together on this night.
Hello and welcome to this very special edition of Newsline, coming to you from Melbourne University, looking at Australia's foreign policy in this very important Asian century. I'm Beverly O'Connor, and it is an absolute delight to be here with you tonight, together with our two very special guests, Richard Miles, who of course is the Parliamentary Secretary for Foreign Affairs and Pacific Islands. Welcome, Richard. And Kelly O'Dwyer, who is the Chair of the Australian Opposition's Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee. And Kelly, lovely to have you with us as well. We're going to hear from both our speakers in just a moment. And importantly, we're going to be throwing the discussion open to yourselves, and we're going to be taking questions from you tonight, because it's very critical as we move into this century that we all participate and understand where we are as a nation going forward. So firstly, to Australia's role in the world, a very big question. Richard, do you want to take the floor?
Thank you. And can I say it's a real pleasure to be here with Beverly and with my good friend and colleague, Kelly O'Dwyer. Australia's place in the world is as an activist middle power. We're not a superpower, and so the world doesn't walk to the beat of our drum, which is why we need to be an activist power, so that we can shape the world in whatever modest way we can. But more importantly, through our deep engagement in the world, we can read international trends so that we can best place Australia in our national interest. And there is this is why you have seen through successive governments Australia be an architect of the G20. It's why we're now on the UN Security Council. It's why today we're the chair of the Commonwealth. But there is no part of the world where the need to be an activist partner is more crucial than in Asia. We live in the fastest economic growing part of the globe, and it's been so important for Australia. And already our engagement with Asia is very deep, from our traditional relationships with Japan to our incredible economic relationship with China. From our relationships with our nearest neighbour, where under the Howard government we saw the birth of a new country on our doorstep, to the excitement of the relationship with India. The single biggest social phenomenon that we will see in the world and in Asia is the growth of the Asian middle class. By 2030, most of the world's middle class will come from Asia. And that has enormous implications for our economic engagement with the region. A transition from a resource-based engagement to one much more around services, education services, health services, professional services, and importantly, agricultural production. But to take advantage of this, we actually need to see a deeper engagement with Asia in the future, even than we've had in the past. And that's why the Australian government has commissioned the Australia and the Asian Century White Paper. Now, at the heart of that is our security relationship with Asia. And often in this context, people talk about the rise of China and our attitude towards it. The truth is that Australia welcomes the economic rise of China, but we also welcome the emergence of an engaged Chinese superpower in a rules-based international order. We want to support the United States' continued involvement in Asia, and we want to see India take its place at the table as well, which is why, in terms of being an activist player, we need to build tables around which those players can sit. And it's why we have been a key player in seeing all of those parties sit around the East Asian Summit and also the ASEAN Regional Forum. We need to continue to build trading relationships. Already the ASEAN Free Trade Agreement is the single biggest agreement that we participate in, but the Trans-Pacific Partnership is also very important. And we need to see our country become more Asian literate, with Asian studies and Asian languages being taught in our schools, with Asian expertise within our businesses, within our government, within civil society. We need to build people-to-people links and cultural ties, and aid is important as well. Indonesia today is the single biggest bilateral development assistance partner that Australia has. And so all of this represents a deep activist engagement in Asia in the tradition of an activist foreign policy. And in this way, we will see Australia shape our future in Asia, not by chance, but by choice. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Richard. Kelly, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Beverly, and thank you very much, Richard. It's a great joy to be with you tonight and to be part of this conversation. I have only 3 minutes, which is very hard for a politician, so I'm going to do my absolute very best, and it's going to be a little bit of an Australian haiku. Over the past 20 years, China and India have almost tripled their share of the global economy and increased the size of their absolute economy 6 times over. Hundreds of millions of people in our region have been lifted out of poverty through economic growth and trade. It's predicted that the middle class in Asia will expand from 500 million people today to over 3 billion people by 2030. Growth like this presents great opportunities for Australia and for Australian businesses. We need to build on the achievements of both sides of politics in developing relationships in the region. As a Liberal, I think some of our key achievements most recently have been the goodwill that we built during the Asian economic crisis and tsunami, about East Timor's independence, about the security ties that we were able to advance with Indonesia through the Lombok Treaty. I think of free trade agreements with the United States of America, with Singapore and Thailand, and the negotiations that we commenced with China, Japan, Malaysia and ASEAN. I think about the evolution of our China relationship during the Howard government years, symbolised by our largest ever export deal of $25 billion. And I think about the fact that we were a founding member of the East Asia Summit from its inception in 2005. As importantly, we need to build upon the work of our businesses, both big and small, that have identified Asia as a great opportunity, not just as a supplier, but as a customer and as a partner. We can't think that proximity simply means that we will automatically benefit from the growth in Asia. You only need to look at today's Australian Financial Review and you can see the potential for competition from overseas, from America with our gas industry. As technology continues to grow, it continues to make distances smaller and it will open up the Asian marketplace to this broader competition. So we need to focus in Australia on being a competitive economy and a predictable trading partner. We need to adapt to the cultural differences across the region and influence how institutions evolve in each economy. Education will be important, so will an investment by government in our bilateral relationships, which will pay very important social and economic dividends. Importantly, this doesn't mean abandoning other long-held relationships. We are perfectly placed to be both a good friend to our long-term ally, the United States, and a better friend to China. There will be challenges too, whether because of the domestic instability that all too often accompanies rapid growth, whether it be terrorism or because of regional disputes that we see in the East China and South China Sea. So we need to strengthen our defence relationships and our cooperation. Whether you call it the Asian century or the global century, the Coalition believes that Australia should have a renewed focus in our region, that we need to maintain our existing strong relationships and alliances and deepen our economic, education, cultural and security ties with our neighbours. Australia's place in the world should be as an innovative, competitive economy, with Australians living in peace and prosperity.
Thanks to both of you, and you've put question time to shame. I think how beautifully you answered those to time. Thank you so much. Now, I'm sure we're going to get down to questions now, and our audience is, I'm sure, very interested to hear some of your responses. To both of you, and Richard, I'll get you to start off on this one first. We heard so much in the launch of the Asian paper about the white paper, about our desire to engage with Asia and the Pacific. How interested are they, though, in engaging with us? Do they really care?
I absolutely think that Asia cares significantly about Australia, and you can see that in the way, well, you can certainly see that in the context of Japan, for example, and the very close defence relationship we have with Japan. From a Japanese perspective, we would be one of their closest defence allies, and we are a very strong partner. And you look at the way in which they reacted to our reaction to the tsunami in Japan. It was actually, you know, very touching in terms of their sense of that. In terms of China, there is no doubt that we're a very significant contributor of iron ore, as an example, which is fueling the construction of China. So, across and India, they absolutely care about our cricket. So, you can look across Asia, I think there is a growing sense of appreciation about Australia, and they do care.
Kelly, what are your thoughts?
Look, I would agree with Richard, and I think tonight there's going to be on much that we can agree. Let's take Indonesia as an example in terms of, you know, what they think of us. I know that certainly the aid program that we have delivered in Indonesia has been absolutely critical in helping strengthen some of the institutions in Indonesia and also strengthening that bilateral relationship. I think it's true to say that education has played a really, really critical part in our engagement with Asia, in the way that they view us and the way that we view them. Who can forget that it was all those years ago when Robert Menzies was Prime Minister that we actually had a Colombo plan. And this has seen more than 40,000 people from Asia come to Australia and experience what it is like to be educated in this country and then go back and take on leadership roles in their own countries.
Sometimes, though, Kelly, that view has been quite xenophobic. We had those terrible riots, racist attacks, on many Indian students. Are you concerned that sometimes, other than the cricket team, how some people view us?
Well, look, I think unfortunately there are always going to be elements in society frankly have views that the common majority don't share, and I think that's very unfortunate. But I think certainly it would be wrong to suggest that all Australians are reflected in that view, and I certainly don't think our neighbours would view us in that way. I think we are a very multicultural society. I think that's one of our great strengths as a country. I think that is recognised not only throughout the region but throughout the world. It's very, very unique.
And I think, Beverly, the other point to make, picking up what Kelly's just said then, in terms of being a multicultural society, we now have very large Asian diasporas in Australia. Some of the biggest communities now in Australia are obviously the Chinese community, but the Indian community is a really significantly growing community within Australia, as, of course, is the Vietnamese community. And there are, of course, ugly incidents which have occurred, but the majority of the way in which we live in our life, here in Australia, is one of enormous acceptance of these communities, and I think that is seen by the host countries themselves.
Kelly, if I can come back to you, I guess Kevin Rudd shocked everyone when he made that speech in Chinese and spoke in another language. That was something quite uncommon for our leaders. When you're sitting on that committee that you do, how Asia literate are our leaders, are our future leaders?
Well, I think that's a very interesting question, certainly for my own part. While it was only schoolgirl Japanese, that was certainly a part of my secondary education, to actually learn another language, a foreign language, a language of our region. That's something I know that is very much a focus of our policy, going into the next election. It's something that is, deep within our DNA that we want to actually see expanded and perpetuated. But in terms of my colleagues, our foreign Shadow Foreign Minister Julie Bishop has been conducting a number of conversation evenings with any member who would like to come along, with ambassadors and consuls from overseas. We've had 10 of those so far. It provides a very, very unique opportunity for everybody to engage, to ask questions, to be better educated. That's something we take incredibly seriously.
Richard.
I think there is room to see us improve in terms of our Asian literacy across government and business and civil society. There's no doubt that Kevin puts us to shame. I've sat next to Kevin in the Parliament as he has tweeted in Mandarin, and apparently, I couldn't tell looking at the screen, but apparently has 250,000 followers in Mandarin. So that is obviously very impressive. I would make this observation about the Australian character, and I really saw this when I was on a trade mission to China last year with Craig Emerson. That kind of there is an openness about the way in which Australians engage, a kind of lack of cultural baggage, a sense of being willing to learn and just to make an effort to fit in and to understand what are the cultural norms. And I saw a knockabout guy from the Gold Coast with exactly those kinds of behaviours. And you can picture that person. It is kind of Australia at its best. He didn't understand Mandarin, but he was really accepted. And people could see the effort that he was making. And he was easy to deal with. And he is kicking goals at a furious rate in terms of the business that he's doing there. So I think we can do more with language. But I actually think we've got a really good platform and a very good national demeanour to take into Asia when we're at our best.
Richard, our asylum seeker policy, you'd have to say, has been characterised by quite a series of sort of changed policy, a number of blunders. We've, offended Indonesia, East Timor, Malaysia. How does that help us with our foreign policy objectives when these kind of things happen on our way to making policy?
Well, we're working closely with the countries of our near neighbourhood in terms of the asylum seeker issue. And what we have is a desire to see people not make what is one of the most dangerous journeys in the world in search of refuge, which is that trip from Indonesia to Christmas Island. And we are deeply engaged with Indonesia at lots of levels, at a police level, at a government level, to try and stop the people smugglers doing this. And I think that that engagement actually enhances our relationship with Indonesia, similarly with Malaysia, and similarly with the other countries who are parties to the Bali process. So I actually think that this is a difficult issue. People understand that it's a regional issue which will need a regional solution. But it is an issue which is seeing countries sit down and work with each other to solve it. And you know, there can be growth in the relationship as a result.
Has it damaged our foreign policy? Has it damaged our reputation, Killian?
Well, I think, unfortunately, I think it actually has. And I suppose this is where we would disagree on this issue. And that is because In the way that the government has dealt with the asylum seeker issue, much like the way that they have dealt with the issue of live animal exports, you know, it has been a surprise to people within the region when announcements are made before discussions have actually taken place with the relevant countries. And of course, when you surprise the region, then the region actually does react. And I think we've seen that with our relationship with Indonesia. I think that we have a lot of repair work to do. We did have a very, very strong relationship with Indonesia during the previous government, where we worked very closely on people smuggling. The one thing we absolutely agree on is the fact that we don't want to see people making these very dangerous journeys across the sea, and we have seen the tragic result of that, which is tremendous loss of life. So I think we do need to work together on this issue. We've obviously got a different policy solution to that, to the one that's been proposed by the government, but there is repair work that needs to be done within the region because of it.
But can I just say, Beverly, it would be wrong to suggest that there is anything other than the deepest relationship that we currently have today with Indonesia. And the best example of that was the trilateral meeting which occurred in the last couple of weeks between President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono, Prime Minister Gillard and Shanana Gusmao, which was an enormously profound moment given the birth of that country under the Howard government, but which we've continued to support. And there is a very close relationship with Australia and Indonesia, and I don't agree with the proposition that there is damage there which needs to be repaired. I actually think the relationship is as close today as it's ever been.
Kelly, if I can come back to you, though, you go further than the government in terms of asylum seeker policy, and that turn back the boats component of it has been heavily criticised. Do you not think that is damaging to Australia's reputation?
Well, really, all that we have proposed doing in the future has been what we did in the past, which is where it is safe and practicable to do so, and that will be in very limited circumstances. You would turn back the boats. We're very upfront about that. It's a policy based on the previous very effective coalition policy when in government. It was part of really a three-part strategy: offshore processing and also temporary protection visas. We think all three elements are critical to being able to slow down any potential people smuggling network, to actually try and break down a people smuggling network, which is seeing a lot of very vulnerable people pay people smugglers upwards of $20,000 in order to get on a boat. That's a criminal network, which we think should not be supported within our region, which is why we believe that we need to take pretty serious measures in order to stop it.
Now, both of you spoke about, a very big industry for Australia, and that has been the education industry. And, Richard, it is, though, getting incredibly competitive, and students have got a wide choice, not only internationally, but also from the growing number of Asian universities that have really improved their credentials. Are we doing enough? Does that remain a critical industry for us going forward?
Well, it's certainly a critical industry. There's no doubt about that. And the observation that it's an industry which exists in a much more competitive environment is also exactly right. And that's why in the Asian Century White Paper there is an aspiration, or if you like, a challenge to see Australia's universities really rise to the world's best, so that we have a significant number in the world's top 100. And the way in which we will survive and thrive in that competitive environment is making sure that we invest in our nation's education so that we have, obviously a great education system for ourselves, but one of the best products on offer for the Asian region.
Look, I would agree with Richard on the point that we need to have a very viable and competitive education, higher education system in this country, and I think that we can be particularly competitive within the region. The point where I would say that there is a bit of a difference between what the government has talked about in the white paper and what it's ultimately delivering has been in the recent MyEFO, which made some pretty difficult decisions around higher education funding, and we have seen significant significant cuts to higher education funding. And I think that where there is that disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality on the ground, it's going to be very hard to see how we can achieve some of those objectives.
Well, I think getting the budget back into surplus is an important objective, and making sure that our fundamentals in Australia and our fiscal policy in Australia is strong is going to be an important platform upon which we engage with Asia. But there is no comparison in the way in which this government has funded higher education compared to the Howard government. We have absolutely structured our budget around health and education, and in terms of education, with a real focus on research and development and a real focus on building our innovation system. And that's the way in which we're going to project our education system as a world-class product into what is going to be a very important market. What is a very important
Can I make
market?
Just a very brief response to that, because I think it can't go unanswered, which is that the health and medical research sector just recently received over $1 billion worth of cuts in MyEFA, which I think is very concerning, given this is one of the areas where I think Australia has a great competitive advantage, particularly within our region, an area that I think is part of the innovation side of our country that we want to see and grow. I would say that in the previous government, in terms of higher education funding, we saw for the very first time established the Higher Education Endowment Fund. This was a $6 billion fund that was set aside in order to make sure that our higher education institutions could be self-funded, to actually give them a sense of autonomy. Now, unfortunately, that money was raided when the government changed, and I think we have seen probably the result of that. So we'll probably agree to disagree on that
and
point.
We'll leave the political point scoring right there. Let's move to audience questions. And we're going to now go to Charles O'Sullivan from a pharmaceutical company called Hospira. Charles, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks very much. Yes, look, I've noticed recently with the US elections, there was a general rhetoric about getting tough on China, perhaps more from Governor Romney. And I'm just wondering about, do you see a potential risk in Australia as well to this backlash about the growth of China? And how real are those risks in Australia compared to the opportunities?
Well, the getting policy right in terms of balancing the relationships between China and the US is making sure that we engage with China in a good security way, and balancing that in terms of our economic relationship. These are the great challenges of Australian foreign policy going forward. But the point that I'd really make is that there is no inevitability about conflict or contest between America and China. There is no inevitable conflict between our economic and our security relationship with China. It's why, in my opening statement, why I said that it was so important to get the parties around the table. And the more we see China engaged, and the more we work with China in that engagement, in aid, in security cooperation, the better things are. And so that's really our challenge. And it's why the East Asian Summit is such an important table for us to be sitting around, but for us to see the United States sitting around with China. It's why the ASEAN Regional Forum is such an important table as well. This is how we get a rules-based order within our part of the world. And I feel very optimistic about China's participation in that. And I think that we need to be continuing, obviously, to build our economic relationship with China, which is going ahead in leaps and bounds. But we will, and I'm sure this will happen under governments of any colour in Australia, we need to continue to build our political and our security relationship with China as well, and we oughtn't to fear that.
Well, I actually do agree with Richard on that point. I would agree with everything that Richard's actually said in relation to that. I don't think we have to make a choice, whether it's China or America. You know, I think we're in a really great position in Australia.
I'm more concerned about the electorate giving you a hard time.
Sure. Look, I think... Yeah, look, I think probably the only issue on which there has perhaps been... A bit of a disconnect on this issue about China has probably been in relation to foreign investment. And I think there has been some discussion in the broader community about this point. I think, though, when you consider that foreign investment has built our country, you know, it is critical to the growth of our country. We have seen huge foreign investment from the United States, from the UK, from a number of other countries. China is now starting to become a significant foreign investor in Australia. This is all very good because it helps us grow our industries, our agricultural industry, which I think will help us also feed the Asian region because we export most of the food that we produce. So I don't think we need to fear it. We also, I think, need to explain the fact that in Australia, our foreign investment rules are quite clear. We always act in Australia's national interest, and there is agreement, I think, on this point between both the government and the opposition. We do have pretty significant rules around sovereign-owned enterprises that get screened, and I think perhaps there's an education that needs to take place with the public about the process that already occurs.
That is spot on.
Let's go to Warren Criddle, from the ANZ.
Warren Criddle. So my question's around, you mentioned it earlier, the growing middle class in Asia. So with increased incomes and the sophisticated taste there, we're going to see an increase in agricultural demand in Australia for our exports, which I like to call the dining boom. What foreign policies do you think would enable us to be best positioned for this?
Yeah. Well, I think the... firstly, again, that observation is right. The opportunity for Australia to be something of the food bowl for Asia is a fantastic opportunity that we simply have to take advantage of. So the first point there is we've got to try and make sure that the trading environment in which we're operating is as liberal and free as possible. And that's why these negotiations around trade agreements are really important. We need to make sure that our own agricultural research is at world's best practice so that we are producing a nutritious product in this country very efficiently, because that's going to become a competitive market as well, and we've got to make sure that we are doing this in a way where we have a product that can compete. And I think the other element of this is making sure that we get the quarantine component of this right, so that we have a quarantine regime which does protect our agriculture and enables us to do this, but which also enables a proper trade. And that's actually can be quite a difficult balance when you get down to the nitty gritty, but it's really important that we get that right also.
And Kelly, just to add though to what Warren said, don't we have to be value added? I think a lot of the criticism of the mining boom, which has been amazing, is that we just sent off all the raw materials instead of value adding and perhaps adding value here.
Yeah, I'm not sure that criticism, though, is completely right. I think that we have seen quite a bit of innovation around mining processes that we have been able to export around the world as well. So I'm not sure that criticism is completely correct. But I do agree with you that we need to be producing a very, very high-end product. That is going to be what our competitive advantage is, a premium product, as Richard says, something that will appeal to the middle class of Asia. And I absolutely think that agriculture is one of our core competitive strengths. We are, you know, the best in the world, I think, with our agricultural CSIRO, the innovation that takes place there. I think we need to ensure that we stay the world's best and that we make sure we have a real strategy around the north of Queensland, which will be one of those areas which can in fact be a launching pad into Asia. So one of the policies that we're going to be releasing over the next week and a half will be exactly on that point, with quite a bit of detail around a discussion paper on how that can be achieved.
Let's go to Hayley Ward, who's from the Australia-China Youth Dialogue. Hayley.
How can young people play a meaningful role in improving Australia's relations with the Asian region?
Go and study and work in Asia. I mean, I really think that exchanges at a people-to-people level are what... I mean, foreign policy and economic cooperation and economic links are based on people. It's not rocket science. And the more you can build personal relationships, the deeper you contribute to Australia's engagement with Asia. I was very fortunate to go to a school where we had many people at the school who were from Thailand, Malaysia and Southeast Asia. They're relationships that I continue to this day. And it it really it adds an element of care and an element of personal engagement, which you just can't get any other way. So aside from obviously the skills one gets in terms of learning Asian languages, which are also very important, go to Asia and make friends.
And I suppose just to build off that, that's why both Tony Abbott and Julie Bishop have been very keen in promoting this idea of reverse Colombo plan. So instead of in the past where we simply had people from the Asian region come and study in Australia, it's also about having our best and brightest go off into the region. There are some pretty amazing institutions overseas, and it's about building those people-to-people links. And I agree with Richard, that is an area where I think we can only deepen and strengthen our ties. And that will pay dividends, not just today, not just tomorrow, but well into the future.
Darcy Butler, the Consulate General of Japan.
I've got a question about the territorial disputes ongoing in Asia. You've already characterised Australia as an activist middle power. In terms of geography, Australia is not directly involved with those ongoing territorial disputes. But if one were to threaten the stability of the region, do you think Australia should be involved in the resolution of that dispute?
Well, I think that we do need to be involved in the region, and we are. In terms of the South China Sea, for example, we don't take a position on the territorial claim, so your point is right there. But it wouldn't be right to say that in not taking a position, we are uncaring, as if you like, about the resolution of that issue. The code of conduct which has been proposed by ASEAN is something that we see as having merit. But at the heart of our engagement on that issue, as an example, is our wanting to see and now seeing the US, China, Japan and others all sitting around at the table of the East Asian Summit and trying to make sure that these are issues that can be talked through there and worked out on the basis of discussion rather than anything else. And actually, whilst there isn't a resolution which is out there which is about to be grabbed, there is at least dialogue. And I do think that Australia has played its part in that. So in that context, yeah, I think we do need to be engaged.
And I think from our perspective, we would want to see a peaceful resolution of those territorial claims. And I think we will see that through the architecture that Richard has described, but also through international law. And I think that most of those countries are looking at their international law obligations and the opportunities under international law to perhaps advance some of those claims and settle some of those claims. And I think, you know, it's not going to be something that is resolved quickly or overnight. I think it's something that will play out over a period of time. I would agree with you, though, it is definitely a flashpoint, and I think we ought to take a very serious interest in it. But in terms of how we engage, I agree with Richard that it is through getting parties together and keeping people talking in a very peaceful, productive way.
A question from Joel Blackwell.
Hi, I've studied Indonesian from high school, and it's helped me at every stage of my career, so I'm a huge advocate of building Asia literacy. But improving Asia literacy in Australia is going to take a very long-term commitment from government. My question is, how do we reconcile this need for a long-term approach with the shorter-term nature of election cycle politics?
Great question. Kelly, maybe you go.
Yes, well, look, I think it's a very good point. I think that on some of these really big national issues, whether it's the issue you've mentioned about Asia literacy or whether it's superannuation policy and a number of other different policies which have long-term impacts on people's futures, we do need to see a coming together, I suppose, across the political divide on issues that are critical to Australia's national interest. I think on that particular issue, you'll find there is a coming together, there is a meeting of minds on that. I suppose there needs to be, though, more than simply a meeting of minds. There needs to be also a follow-on, a funding, a skills building so that we can deliver on it, not just talk about it. And as laudable as those aims were in the Asia Century White Paper, I didn't see any evidence of the government looking at how it can follow through with that aspiration and deliver that on the ground with particular funding commitments or the skilling up of teachers to be in our schools to actually give that education. So I think we need to come together, I suppose, and make sure that it's not just talk, but it's also about action.
Well, I was about to say I agree with everything that Kelly said, but there was a little sting in the tail there. But basically what Kelly says is right, in as much as the only way you get over political cycles is if you do achieve a bipartisan agreement or a bipartisan position. And we need to have that on the importance of teaching Asian studies in our education system and teaching languages. And look, Kelly's also right in saying that this is something which has to be funded. None of this comes for free. We are very engaged in increasing our expenditure on education, and we have since we've come to power. We're keen to balance the budget, but if you look at what we've done in terms of our budget since 2007, there is a much greater expenditure on education at a federal level than there's ever been before. And we are committed through the Asian Century White Paper process to see that there is funding which is available for the teaching of Asian studies and Asian languages at school.
Further to Joel's point, though, I mean, both of you would have to agree that this last parliament has been very characterised by rather ugly negative politics. What sort of face do you think that puts onto the rest of the world when our Prime Minister has to go out and sort of go on the attack?
Look, I think that people understand democracies as robust places. I think that I often have a lot of international visitors who come via my office in the morning and are about to head off to question time in the afternoon, and I feel like I need to give them a warning about what they're about to see and not to worry too much about it. The truth is that when you see them afterwards, they're delighted by the contest that they've witnessed and the theatre of it, and sometimes there is a fair bit of theatre and pantomime as part of it. So I don't think it plays negatively in terms of the way in which we're perceived, and people understand the kind of debate that comes with a robust democracy. And just as we enjoy watching that kind of debate in an American context, for example, you know, I think others enjoy watching it in Australia, and I don't think it has any effect in terms of the way we're seen at all.
Look, I wish I could agree with you on that, because I think, unfortunately, you know, a minority government, I think, has had a bit of an impact on how people probably view us internationally. But I think domestically, I think it certainly has had an impact. And I think, unfortunately, politicians on that Reader's Digest Most Trusted Professions has sunk to a new low, which is very unfortunate for my poor mother, who would like to see my sort of career improving from, you know, lawyer, banker, politician, but she thinks it's been going in the other direction. Anyhow, that's an aside. I mean, the serious point, though, in all of that is that I do think that certainty and having business certainty around how a government will respond and react on particular issues or in building particular frameworks around, for instance, tax or something else. I think that is very important for confidence. I think that's very important for investment. And when we consider how important foreign investment is to our country and to in growing our economy, I do think, unfortunately, it does have quite a serious economic impact, not just an impact in people sort of thinking probably less of politicians. So I think it is serious. I think, frankly, that sooner we don't have a minority government, the better we will be, because I think people will at least then have confidence that someone is directly in charge and will be able to make decisions for the future of the country, whether that's the Labor Party or whether that's the Liberal Party.
We're now going to throw the debate open to some broader questions, but you've been doing so beautiful with your brevity, I urge you to continue that so we can keep the discussion going. If you can raise your hand and we'll get microphones to you. So I think we've got a couple down here, as we would have it right in the... Maybe come... Oh, beautiful. Perhaps have another microphone ready so we can just move straight forward. Now they're fighting over the microphones.
It's not just us.
If you can, yes, stand up if you'd like, if you could, thank you.
Yeah, I'm Director of Cultural Intelligence. Both of you mentioned culture as an important aspect to the Asia Century. My question is, what's the connection between, and is there a policy to connect between migrants and the foreign policy and the trade? Because even just looking at the Asia Century white paper, there's a lack of connect between people who are already here, who understands culture, and people continue to find that being a migrant, it's difficult to find opportunities, and also supporting international students, supporting them to find opportunities to help us through the Asia Century.
Terrific.
Well, firstly, I think the observation of the role that communities in Australia can play in our relations with other countries is a really important observation to make, and there is a huge role that can be played. As I mentioned earlier, the Indian community, the Vietnamese community, the Chinese community, but we've also got other significant communities from across Asia. There is a great opportunity that people from those communities have in helping Australia engage with Asia. And making sure that we do have cultural intelligence is a really important aspect of the way in which we are going to build trust and a sense of confidence of these countries in Australia. And we've got, you know, we've got teachers within our own community who we definitely need to use. So I think that there is a huge role for those communities to play, and I think it's one of the great advantages we have in terms of the way in which we can engage with Asia going forward.
Yeah, I think that is broadly right. Can I sort of tackle your question though in a slightly different way? I think our approach to migration is an interesting question as well. Certainly under the previous government, there was a very strong focus on skilled migration and probably less of a focus on family reunion. And I think if you're probably looking at perhaps the differences between the two parties, if in fact I accurately reflect this or not, there is certainly on our side of politics a very strong view that we ought to be encouraging a really strong and dynamic skilled migration to Australia to help us to build our skills, to be able to provide those sorts of opportunities in our country that we need. I think we were at a historic high during the last government. So that's an area where I think there's probably scope for a bit more debate, and the ease of being able to bring in people from overseas, again, you know, with the amount of regulation and red tape that is around a lot of that skilled migration, I again think that there is scope for us to be easing that process and making it much more streamlined.
Can I just say in relation to both those points, skilled migration definitely has a really important role to play. And, and in both the points that Kelly raised, which I really do agree with in terms of the need to have have skilled migration here and the role that it can play, but also, you know, easing the arrangements around that. That all is addressed in the white paper, and the role that skilled migration can play in terms of our engagement is seen as a critical piece of the puzzle.
Take a question. I think we have a microphone over there.
Hi, I'm Sinyi from the NEMBC. I was wondering, how would the government, I guess, play a more leadership role in encouraging media in Australia to portray China in a more positive light?
Well, I might have a crack at that. I don't think really it's government's role to control the media or dictate to the media how they ought to be representing issues. I think we are in a time where we have a number of different media platforms. I mean, we've got the traditional ABC, which we love, and we've now got three different channels on the ABC, but we've also got people who are now part of the mainstream media who have blogs that people read, you know, blogs read by millions of people. So I think the idea that the government needs to sort of dictate one view on how we ought to present to, you know, particular countries or vice versa is one that simply can't be sustained, nor do I think it's one that we want to sustain. We've got slightly different views on the idea of a media regulator too. I mean, you know, we have very strong views that it should be a full, frank and fearless media. There are going to be things that we don't like in terms of what people say. There are going to be things that offend us. But at the end of the day, that is the role and function in an active and vibrant democracy to have a very strong media.
I very much agree with the proposition that the government doesn't have a place in telling the media what to say about a particular issue, and I think that is a line which is very important that government doesn't cross. I do think that there is an ability for government to try and lead a national discourse which encourages more reporting on Asia. So in that sense, I'm not talking about what that reporting says about Asia, but that there is actually more content from Asia being reported into our domestic situation. I think that is actually something which would be a welcome development. And I think government it's certainly not about dictating to media to say you've got to report more in Asia, but I do think that there can be some leadership shown by government about the importance of Asia to our country and why it therefore is meritorious of attention.
The reason why I use the word dictate, though, is because we already have quite strong, you know, content rules and obligations around traditional media, where they have to, for instance, show a certain number of hours of children's television and the like. And I certainly wouldn't want to see us going in a direction where we're actually dictating particular content requirements. As laudable as those aims might be, I simply don't see that as a role for government.
Let's move on.
Hi, thanks for being here. Natalie Cope, Manager of Partnerships and Development at AsiaLink and Deputy Director of the Australia-China Youth Dialogue. The PricewaterhouseCoopers Melbourne Institute AsiaLink Index, which is a multi-indicator measure of Australia's engagement with Asia, was recently released. And while overall engagement with Asia indeed increased over the past 12 months, there was a 50% reduction from Chinese investment into Australia. So knowing that data, my question is probably twofold. One, what is your belief as to the reason for that trend? And question two is, what should Australia do to address that trend?
Well, I'm not sure whether you can discern a trend over a 12-month period is probably the first answer to the question. But certainly, Kelly answered this question earlier about the importance of Chinese investment into Australia, and that's something with which I completely agree. And so we do need to be making sure that we continue to work to make the ease of investment, or to increase the ease of investment. And I think that's where making sure that there is complementary, that we, if you like, have harmonised financial regulation between countries within Asia, and that again is an objective identified in the white paper as something worth pursuing. It's very micro, but it's really important to make the flow of capital easier between countries within Asia. It's why obviously trade agreements are really important. And so I think that doing everything we can to reduce the thickness of the border, if you like, or the borders within Asia, but particularly the border between Australia and Asia, in terms of financial investment, is going to be the ongoing challenge in public policy in Australia.
I think specifically in response to China, although I think it does apply to other countries as well when it comes to investment in Australia, the point I made earlier about having certainty around taxation policy and a variety of other government policies, I think, is quite critical. I think when a country gets known as being a country where there are sovereign risk concerns, and we have seen that, we have seen reportage of that in the Financial Times and overseas, I think that's where people start to really pull back in making investment decisions to come and actually invest in Australia. The second part, I suppose, to your question would be that I think we have an enormous opportunity to conclude a free trade agreement with China, which I think would be very much in our mutual interest. It's a free trade agreement that's been on foot for over 7 years now, something that was instigated by the previous government. Still hasn't been concluded, and I think we're in our 16th iteration of it. New Zealand was able to conclude a free trade agreement with China within 3 years. I certainly think an additional focus on ensuring that we make that happen would be quite useful.
Can I just pick up on one thing, which was the sovereign risk point? I mean, I get the political reason why that point has been made, but the idea that there is any sense of sovereign risk that Asian countries feel in Australia is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we have one of the strongest economies in the world. We have a AAA rating from the three international rating agencies. We're seen as having a strong fiscal policy. We're seen as being a predictable, high-standard country. That is not an argument which bears scrutiny, and whilst it might play into a domestic audience, there is absolutely no way in Asia people see that at all. Now, that's not to say that there isn't more work which needs to be done on what I said before in terms of reducing the thickness of the border between Australia and Asia. There does, and there's a lot more work that can be done on that, and the Asian Century White Paper highlights a number of those areas, and we need to keep working on that. But I do have to contest that point.
Enough.
Hi, my name's Alison Hardacre. Central to the engagement with Asia is learning Asian languages, but there's a real perception out there that Asian languages are really hard to learn, particularly for people of non-Asian descent. I've been lucky enough to learn 5 Asian languages, and I'm obviously not Asian. How can we get the message out there that they're not that hard? They're not as hard as we think.
You might be exceptional.
I think you're going to be the poster child. I'm very fortunate that my brother-in-law is a sinophile. You know, he is a fluent speaker. He spent some time in China. I think there is a real thirst for learning in Australia, and I think you're right to say that we do need to encourage people to think about Asian languages, because you're right, I think there is a perception that they are more difficult than other languages like French or German. Certainly that was definitely the perception at my school, and when people are considering their final marks to get into university and to make choices about their careers and down the track, I think a lot of people look at marks first and perhaps think later about whether or not it's going to be useful in their long-term career. So I don't have a perfect answer for you on that, but I would agree with you, it is an issue.
Yeah, look, I don't have a perfect... I think it's a really good observation, and I don't have a necessarily perfect answer to that either. And I think the point that Kelly made is exactly right. I mean, that people do obviously at school look for marks, and I can well imagine why people would make those choices. But I think part of it is that we've really got to encourage people to take up Asian languages as young as possible, and we've just got to repeat the importance of what comes from those languages and learning them. I mean, to be able to have Mandarin in your back pocket is of a completely different order of magnitude of usefulness than having German. I mean, that for an Australian, that's the truth of the matter, and we've just got to keep repeating that message.
Go ahead.
And I'm a student here at the University of Melbourne. I was just wondering if you could both elaborate on our relationship with America. And you've both agreed that you've rejected the idea that we have a choice between America and China. And whilst I'd accept that, I was wondering if you would accept the proposition that our dependency on a great and powerful ally could inhibit our ability to engage in active, I believe you said activist, middle power foreign policy, and thus our engagement with Asia in the Asian century. Thanks.
Well, I don't think it does. I think it is a continuation of a long-term relationship and alliance. I mean, I don't think we have to choose between our geography and our history. And our relationship with America and the US is very deep. It's based on having fought in conflicts together. It's based on the fact that we share so many values. Our security arrangements with the US, I would applaud the government with the announcement that was made, I think only in November of last year, where we are seeing a deepening of that engagement with the US, where we are having troops rotate in Darwin, and I think that is actually a good thing. My view is it's not going to inhibit our ability to engage with our neighbours. So many of our neighbours within the Asian region actually also have very, very strong alliances with the United States. I mean, take Japan as just one example. So the idea that in being a good friend and strong ally to the US means that we are not going to have as strong a relationship with many of our neighbours in the Asian region, I think is just not correct.
Look, that's right. Our most important bilateral relationship in the world is with the United States of America, and it's going to be that way for a long time to come. It is that in a security sense, and we actually have a very strong economic relationship with the US as well. But we don't have to make a choice, and in many respects, I think we can play something of a role as a bit of a bridge between the US and Asia. And I think actually successive governments and successive personal relationships between prime ministers and presidents, and indeed between foreign ministers and secretaries of state, have done that. And John Howard was very close to George Bush. I think that was probably an important thing in terms of seeing a greater engagement by the US in this part of the world. I think there is no doubt that this government has a very close relationship with the United States administration. And again, I think we've played a pretty important role in the US engagement in this part of the world recently. So I think Australia can be something of a bridge in that relationship. And the important point to make is that in being a bridge, our objective is to make sure that we do bring China and the US around the same table, and we do play our part
in creating a global order which sees both countries cooperating in a security and a political sense as well as an economic sense.
Tariq, there's a question in the middle there.
Good evening. My name is Jeremy Owen. I've got a question relating to general sort of a federal MP engagement in local culture and events. I spent several years living in China, and moving back, you do go through reverse cultural shock, but getting over that, you know, I engaged with language groups and all that sort of thing. And what I want to know is, how engaged are you as federal MPs and your colleagues in whether that's Asian events, Asian clubs, and is that a good way to contextualize and develop a contextual experience to shape policy and our Asian policy that we're coming up with?
Richard, you spend every second minute.
As the PAL Sec for Foreign Affairs, I spend a fair bit of time in Asia, but I suspect your question is how does it work as a local member of parliament? And the answer is there are significant Asian communities in Geelong, which is where my constituency is, and I do go to lots of those events, and there is absolutely no doubt that my participation in those has really informed and really assisted my work as Australia's Parliamentary Secretary for Foreign Affairs and dealing with the bilateral relationships, which comes back to the point before. There is no doubt in my mind about the significance that our diaspora communities can play in building the bilateral relationships between Australia and the home countries. And it is it's a community that we do need to leverage more going forward.
In a similar sort of way, I've also been engaged with not just local groups, but individuals from within my community. And I also provide lots of opportunities for people to contact me and meet with me. You know, I think I've had 14 community forums. At the last community forum I held, actually, one of the most curious things to me down in, you know, downtown Carnegie was the fact that we actually had quite a significant discussion about foreign investment policy, which was of interest to the people who'd sort of walked in off the street to have a discussion about it. So I do think, you know, as MPs, if we're doing our job correctly and rightly, you know, we're connected in with our local communities. And I think part of the job we perform is to be educated, but also to educate, to learn, and to deepen some of those relationships.
And sorry, can I just... Yeah. The constituency that you had and the meetings you had, was it mainly Asian participants and Asian participants?
No. No, actually, we had about 80 people down in the Carnegie Library, and it's a mix. I mean, Australia is a multicultural community, but predominantly, I would say not. And yet, this was quite an interesting question that people wanted to talk about. It must have been around the time of Cubby Station, and I think there was quite a bit of discussion about, you know, what does this mean? What does it mean for Australia? What is our take on that policy? And people wanted to inform me of their views as well.
Hello, my name's Michelle Isles. Climate change is already having an impact within our region. We're seeing that through food security issues. So thinking about a food bowl in Australia, is at risk potentially. So how might we best cooperate to reduce carbon emissions through bilateral or multilateral relations? Thank you.
Well, I don't know whether this is an area where we might have a difference, but I mean, the answer to that is that... Well, firstly, we need to have a pricing of carbon within our own economy, which we now have. We need to be having our own carbon trading market as it develops, plug as much as possible into other markets around the world. We're now doing that with Europe. The more that we do that, the more we will encourage other countries to participate in similar schemes, and I think that's the best thing we can do in terms of encouraging Asian countries to do the same. And then, of course, through the UNFCCC process, what we've got to be engaged in is trying to have a globally binding agreement, which out of Durban, there is enormous hope that will now be negotiated by 2015. So, you know, there is a comprehensive way in which we're engaging on this issue, and we absolutely need to keep it going because, as you rightly say, we are we are seeing climate change have its impact here in Australia, and I spend a lot of time in the Pacific as well, and they are communities which are really on the front line of climate change. And in a country like Kiribati, which is a low-lying coral atoll country, where the highest point above sea level is about three or four metres, I mean, there is a the sense of vulnerability to the sea and the sense of vulnerability associated with climate change is palpable in the way that it's hard to describe here, and it just does remind me every day of our need to be active on this issue.
In terms of the impact of climate change on Australia, I would vehemently disagree that we have a food security issue in Australia. We actually produce more food than we can consume. We export the bulk of the food that we actually produce in this country. So I don't for one minute think that we have a food security issue in Australia, which is something that I know a lot of people have talked about, but I think is just out and out when you look at the facts of it completely wrong. In terms of climate change and putting a price on carbon in the Asian region, we haven't seen any economy-wide carbon trading scheme or carbon tax that's been applied within the Asian region. I would agree with Richard on the point that I do think that having a global agreement around pricing carbon is something that we should look at and look at very seriously, and that's consistent with the policies that we have discussed from election to election. Because it is a global problem, it does require a global solution. And in Australia, we're less than 1.5% of the world's emissions. And frankly, we think putting a carbon tax, and this is where it gets a little bit more political, putting a carbon tax on Australian households and Australian businesses is to our great competitive disadvantage, particularly when you consider that our Asian neighbours most certainly are not doing that.
We have a question over here.
Hi, my name is Abdul. I'm from the city of Melbourne. I understand we've got a great interest on India and China, and Richard's point that it's they have got a favourable interest on Australia as well. Although the last Prime Minister of India visited India since 1986, Rajiv Gandhi, I guess. So I'm not sure it's a diplomatic failure of Australia or India's ignorance. My question is to Kelly anyway about the uranium issue. Although India is not at didn't sign the non-proliferation treaty. So what will be coalition's government view on this? Are you going to backflip on Labor's policy or what?
Well, no, we argued. I think I probably ought to correct the record here, because I think it's safe to say we've been arguing consistently for a very long time that we ought to sell uranium to India, that this was one of the great barriers in our relationship with India, with deepening our relationship with India. And it's something we have maintained very consistently, and we're very pleased that the Labor Party have recently come to the view that this is something that they also agree with. So there would be no change in that policy. It's one that we advocated. It's now one that Labor shares, and we think that will definitely strengthen the relationship with India.
Requires no response from you, Richard.
Hi, my name's David Pledger. I've been working as an artist in Asia for more than 20 years, so I'm actually interested in the cultural dimension of the future foreign policy. And key nations like Singapore, and in particular Korea, they've really put culture at the forefront of their international engagement. The reason being that if other countries understand how they express themselves, how they think and work and play, then they will be interested in thinking and working and playing with them. Really up to date, we've adopted a kind of 20th century nation state marketing approach, which hasn't done us a lot of favours. And I'm hoping that the white paper will have a shift there. But I'm interested in how a more nuanced cultural engagement in the overall future foreign policy is perceived as valuable by both sides of the parties.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would agree with you. I think it is critically valuable, and I think to our great detriment, we haven't focused on this issue probably nearly enough. I think previously Australians have probably thought that the great sort of wonderful export that we have and something we share in common with a lot of the world has been our sport, which is true. You know, sport has been one of those wonderful things that we have been able to connect with communities not only in Asia but right across the world. But I certainly think there is a very strong role to play when connecting culture.
sector. And one example that I can think of is, you know, we have one of the world's premier ballet companies, the Australian Ballet. And the Australian Ballet recently in its 50th year went over to New York. But I certainly know they were very, very keen to actually go to China. They didn't have the funding to go to China. I think it would be spectacular if we could take one of our great cultural exports, take it to our neighbours within the Asian region and demonstrate just how significant as a country we are culturally, and use that as a way to engage with other countries as well, and also have the opportunity to have reciprocal visits from cultural institutions and organisations that a premier in other countries as well. I think it's something we should definitely do.
I think you make a really good point, and the way in which you made it is exactly right. It's culture is a projection of who we are, and as people get to know with us, the sort of sense of feeling happier about playing with us, I think was your language, is exactly right. I mean, and I think this is something which has got to be up front and centre in terms of how we present ourselves to Asia going forward. I actually include sport in the concept of culture, and like if you look at India, we're going to have a huge relationship with India going forward, much bigger than we have at the moment. That will be both in a political security sense, but very much in an economic sense. That we both play cricket really matters. I mean, they do know a whole lot about Australia from cricket. But Kelly's also right, and you're right, that it can't just be about sport. I actually did have the joy of seeing the Australian Ballet perform in Tokyo last year, and they were a hit and really presented a different perception of Australia, a kind of more, a smarter, more sophisticated Australia than perhaps what they'd imagined. Right now in India at the moment is Ozfest, which was launched a couple of weeks ago when the Prime Minister was in India, and will go through until February. It's got a whole lot of exhibitions, art exhibitions, photographic exhibitions. I heard a performance when I was in India the week before last from Amber Hammond, who is a young Australian pianist from Sydney who was performing around New Delhi and Goa and other parts of India. Again, an absolute hit. And it's great for her career because she's been invited back literally after her first performance, but is presenting a totally different view of how people perceive Australia. And that opens people's minds to engaging with us in a much more deeper way, but I actually think a more trusted way as well. So the cultural lead is a really important way of thinking about how we engage, and a lot can flow from that.
Hi, my name is Evelyn. My question is in relation with healthcare professionals who migrate to Australia. I just want to know whether there's anything in terms of policy that the government is doing to help with workplace integration of these healthcare professionals who migrate to Australia.
Well, there is, and there are programs in place which encourage health professionals to come to Australia and particularly to work in regional parts of Australia where the numbers of health professionals to the population, if you like, are less than what they'd be here in the middle of Melbourne. And there are quite good packages which encourage people to come and in terms of their visa arrangements and the way in which they're supported into those jobs. Excuse me. And I definitely think that getting having that kind of professional engagement is a really important way of engaging with Asia, and health professionals certainly play a key part in that.
I think we're going to be seeing an increasing number of healthcare professionals coming to Australia because, of course, we face similar sorts of demographic challenges that quite a number of other nations face with the ageing of the population. We are going to need a skilled workforce to be able to help us with a lot of the healthcare needs that we know will exist with a population that is growing older. We're going to see, you know, just off the back of the latest intergenerational report, we're going to see a tripling of healthcare costs, which will mean that we require a workforce to be able to support that. So I would agree with Richard that we need to make sure that that workforce is properly supported so that they can be delivering the quality of care that we expect to be receiving in this country, and also to be able to deliver the sort of experience and professional experience that anybody coming here would also expect to receive.
We're going to take one final question. We are running well over our allocated time, but lucky last up the back.
Thanks a lot. I'm Ronald, and I'm a futurist and a civil servant. I've got two questions for you, or two main areas of concern. One is Australia's ability to remain engaged in Asia in 20 years' time, because most policy are usually designed for the short term, as most people would say, knee-jerk reactions. So, one, how would you deal with Asia's population and dynamic energy and also rising military and economic power, because in 10 to 20 years' time, or even now, Asia will soon eclipse Australia, and we will be a shadow or a small dot in the bigger scheme of things. And in relation to that, what are we going to do about our aging infrastructure versus all the new infrastructure in Asia and the rising cost of building infrastructure and doing business in Australia? And then, in terms of,
I think that's where we're going to have to leave it, because we're getting almost as many questions as the entire debate. So let's cut it off there. And I think what your first question is probably largely already being answered, but perhaps it is a relevant one, that the pace of change and development is huge.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we're seeing an explosion in population size. I mean, we're already, from a population point of view, completely and utterly eclipsed. But there is real opportunity with that. I think both Richard and I have talked about the growing middle class, the fact that we are going to have new consumers for high-end products. One of the ways that we can deliver that is to ensure that the sort of products that we are producing in this country, the sort of products, of course, that people within Asia and you know, the exploding populations there are going to want to purchase. So we need to continue to be innovative. We need to make sure that where we can, we absolutely reduce the red tape and regulation that applies to business. That's one of the things that I know a lot of businesses talk about in this country, is holding them back from being able to grow and develop and have that deeper engagement. So I think from an economic point of view, that's something we'd focus on. From a security point of view as well, ensuring that we have those deeper security ties through military exercises, through ensuring that we have reciprocal exercises with people in different countries within Asia that already exist now, to ensure that continues, absolutely, that's something that we would commit to, and I'm sure that's something that Richard would commit to as well.
Mm. Well, I think the fundamental proposition in your question, that this can't be short term, that we do need to be conceiving this policy over the long term, is exactly right. And that's why we've talked about Australia in the Asian century. It is imagined that the trends we're talking about here are going over a long period of time. And as I think we answered in an earlier question, it's really important that to have consistent policy over that period of time, that we do build bipartisan support around this. And I think from today, what you can see is that that's happening. I think in terms of defence engagement, it's really important that continues to be the case. We have defence cooperation agreements with every one of the ASEAN member countries, with the exception of Myanmar. We have very close arrangements and relationships with Japan, and we're always on the lookout to do more cooperation with the other countries within Asia. And in terms of infrastructure, that's also an important observation. We do need to see that our own infrastructure keeps pace, not the least of which is our telecommunications infrastructure, which is why we're investing so much in the National Broadband Network.
That is all we have. That very partisan chuckle is where we
won't go through to the keys.
In that cricket parlance, Kelly, thank you. That is where we are going to leave our discussion. I'd like to thank all of you, the audience. You've been terrific. To AsiaLink and the University of Melbourne for facilitating it, but particularly to our fabulous guests. Thank you so much for a very frank and open discussion. Richard Miles and Kelly O'Dwyer, please thank them.